Up next, we have our first keynote of the conference, Brand to Demand, Fueling Growth in Tough Times by Tom Wentworth, Chief Marketing Officer at Recorded Future. Please give a big round of applause for our next keynote.
We need hype music.
Get so big and bright, it's supernatural delight. Everybody
love hearing Mike. Good morning, everybody. This is a low-energy group. It's a good thing I'm a high-energy presenter. I will transfer my energy graciously over to all of you. So I'm Tom. I'm the Chief Marketing Officer at Recorded Future. We are a $300 million-ish threat intelligence company. I had to remember quickly. I was thinking, my presentation doesn't have anything about AI in it, which is a little, seriously. However, there are two places where I did use AI. One was that headshot you saw right there. That was not a real headshot. That was an AI-generated headshot. I do not look like that. My hair is nowhere near as good as what I just saw on that screen. And the session description that you might be seeing in your packet was also written by ChatGPT. I wrote it a long time ago, back when ChatGPT was cool. But it was verbatim, word for word, written by ChatGPT. So that's the only mention of AI in this presentation. Is going to be my headshot and the ChatGPT summary. So that's good, right? Okay. Wow, I got to really work hard this morning. Did you guys all go out last night? I didn't get in until 12:30. So I should be the one who's slacking this morning, not you. But we're going to step it up here. I promise you. I talk fast. I'm sorry about that. I apologize in advance. I will do my best to do this at a reasonable pace. I get really fired up about this particular topic. And we'll get into it. It's sort of my story, but we'll get into it. Okay, so I'm going to focus on three things here this morning. And by the way, we got 50 minutes, 5-0. So get comfortable, stretch out, have some coffee. We're going to be together for quite some time. 50 minutes is a long time to listen to any presentation, especially me. I apologize in advance for that. So we've got three things we're going to focus on this morning. Why you won't hit your number without building a brand and investing in brand awareness. That's the thesis here. I've failed at this in my career. I think I finally figured it out here at Recorded Future. I'm going to share the good and the bad of my experiences. Why the 50% of your marketing budget that's so-called wasted? Who said that? Who's the 50% wasted guy again? Like, who's the person who said that? Someone has to know. Or is it just like no one actually said it? Somebody said, none of us know who it was, but somebody said that 50% is wasted. I'm going to argue today why that's actually the good part of your marketing budget. We should waste money. Strange. And then lastly, I'm going to go through some suggestions that I have for organizations with big, medium, and small marketing budgets, again, based on my experience, because I've had all three of these before. Okay. Does that sound good? All right, let's do it. Disclaimer, this is really important. I didn't want to put this in. I didn't want to be all negative on slide number two. But the reality is nothing bothers me. LinkedIn, how many of y'all are LinkedIn addicts like me? How much awful advice do we get on LinkedIn? These so-called LinkedIn B2B marketing SaaS influencers. My boy Dave Gerhardt, shout out, love him. Chris Walker, people that you like post 14 times a day. Like, don't listen to anyone. And don't listen to me. Like, do not listen to me. The reality is everything I talk about here today, everything that you see talked about on LinkedIn might only work for the person who's writing the post or doing the presentation. The stuff that works for me may or may not work for you. My job is to maybe give you some things to think about, but you all have to contextualize it to your business, your marketing team, your budget, your focus, your industry, your product. So, like, just because Tom said, oh, yeah, we had this great podcast, I don't know if a podcast is going to work for you, don't do it. Like, so you don't have to listen to people, especially LinkedIn. You can listen to me, but LinkedIn, super sketchy. Do not listen to LinkedIn. All right. So let's talk about how I got here. Yes, that's a Lamborghini. We'll talk about that in a second. I've made this picture myself, by the way. Every slide in here was not done by my designer. It was done by me. That'll explain a lot as we get into this. So how did I get here? So I've been in tech for 29 years. I'll let you all do the math on how old that makes me. You can probably figure it out for some mathematicians, 29 plus. So I've been doing this for a while. And all of my peers and friends who've been doing this as long as I have, they're not flying out at 12:30 in the morning. They're not schlepping around at hotels like I am. Why am I still here? Like, they're all sitting on boards. They're like, they do one or two fractional CMO. Anybody a fractional CMO in this room? Wow. Okay. Like, the fractional CMOs, I don't know what a fractional CMO does. I would like to be one, but I don't know what it is. It's my dream to be a fractional CMO. So I've been doing this thing for 29 years, and I'm still here flying in planes from Boston to Austin in bad weather, landing at 12:30, being exhausted. Why? Shouldn't I be retired? Shouldn't I be a fractional CMO? Shouldn't I be sitting on boards and, like, I don't know, but I'm not. I don't have a Lambo. Like, my dream, I'm clearly in the middle of a midlife crisis, right? Like, look at me. Look at these shoes. Midlife screams midlife crisis. Could not scream more midlife crisis, right? But I can't be in a midlife crisis. Like, I can't. I'm not there yet. I've got to get to that point. So why am I not fully in my midlife crisis? Because I've made some mistakes. And that's what we're here to talk about today, so that you, when you're my age, and I don't recommend it, by the way, stay, whatever age you are, stay. It's terrible to get old. When you're my age, you will not have to go through this failure of a midlife crisis that I'm going through, so you can learn from my mistakes. So let's talk about the three mistakes that I made, and let's not actually, did I skip over the most important slide? Okay, so these are three career experiences that were formative in my failures as a CMO. The most recent one, Recorded Future, is not an entire failure, but I've certainly failed at Recorded Future as well. Don't get me wrong. So three companies I'm talking about. I was a CMO of a company called Optimizely. It was a company, became Optimizely. That was my first real CMO job, and I'll talk about some things I learned there. I was a sales engineer for the first half of my career, so I went sales engineer to marketing, which is a really weird transition. I'm not really good at marketing, to be candid. Maybe that's the problem. That's why I'm not retired yet or on a fractional CMO. My second job was at a company called Acquia, which I'll talk about, a much bigger company, about the same size as Recorded Future is today. And my current experiences at Recorded Future, where I've been here now for 4 years, which for all y'all, how many of you are heads of marketing in this room? It is wild to be a head of marketing at one company for 4 years. I haven't been fired yet. Like, it's an absolute miracle. I was talking to, owned by Insight Partners, a pretty large private equity company, and I think one day they were saying to me recently, like, you're the longest tenured CMO in our portfolio. Like, I don't want to hear that. Like, that just means you're going to, like, well, you got a countdown clock somewhere? Like, what's going on here? Are you going to fire me? Very likely. Okay. So let's talk about my first experience. Again, as a sales engineer, I'd never been in marketing a day in my life. One of the great things, though, about being a sales engineer is we partner a lot with marketing, especially product marketers. Any product marketers in the building today? Love product marketers. Let's go. I have a few openings Recorded Future. Didn't say that out loud. So I spent a lot of time with product marketers but knew nothing about marketing. So to learn about marketing, like, literally, just to say nothing, I went from being an SE to CMO. My journey to CMO was this. Was in this company, Optimizely. The CEO came in my office, an office back then, and said, hey, Tom, we're going to fire the VP of marketing. He kind of sucks. He's wasting money. I'd like to make you, like, the head of marketing. I'm like, oh, that's cool. I don't know anything about it, but I can try. I read a lot. I know some things. I don't know. I'll try. And I said, oh, by the way, and he said, oh, you can be the VP of marketing. That's great. Yeah, I can be the VP of marketing. I'll try. I'll read some stuff. Can I just be CMO? That sounds like a cooler title. Sure, you can be CMO. So literally my journey was being like a head of sales engineering to being CMO just because I was dumb and didn't even know that was a thing. So I had to fake it till I make it. So first, when I became CMO, the first thing I did is I got to figure this stuff out. And I read every single piece of content at the time put out by Marketo. Marketo was great. This guy, John Miller, who's still around, he's somebody you should listen to. He's what the kids call an OG. So he was the founder of Marketo and has moved on to Demandbase. Now he's retired, I think. It's back to the retiring thing. And Marketo taught me a lot that marketing was really just funnels and math. I thought at the time marketing was like building pretty pictures and like setting up booths at trade shows and like handing out t-shirts. I didn't know what marketing was, but I learned from Marketo it's really about funnels and math, which made me good as a math major. I can do math. Like, I can do basic algebra and multiplication and division. So maybe this marketing thing isn't so hard. So I read every single piece of content Marketo put out about that time, and it's all about earning a seat at the revenue table. right? Marketing was this like arts and crafts department. Marketing did all the stuff that didn't matter. Sales is where it at. And for sales to take marketing seriously, marketing had to be in it to win it along with sales and had to be actively contributing. So that's what I learned. And then I learned from who I believe to be the GOAT, the greatest of all time at marketing, which is Mike Volpe, who was a CMO at HubSpot, employee number 3, sort of a co-founder. HubSpot has gone on to become this enormous company, and Mike's was there to start it. And you know, Mike's point at HubSpot, and the reason that HubSpot was started, is because everything in marketing should be measured and connected to revenue. Everything should be measured. So here I am in the earliest days of being a CMO, being told that everything should be measured. That's terrible advice, terrible advice. But I didn't know any better. Everything should be measured, no. Everything should be measured is what your CFO wants to believe, your CEO wants to believe, but that's not the reality of what we do. You can't measure the good stuff. But Mike taught me I had to measure everything. I still love Mike, and I know both Mike and John a little bit, but Mike was darn wrong on this one. So that's what I learned. And that company kind of, like, it finally did well, but I left that company after a couple of years being a CMO for the first time and got recruited to join this company called Acquia. Acquia was a little bit bigger, about $40 million in ARR when I started. Acquia is most known as being the company behind the Drupal CMS system, one of the most exploited pieces of technology on the planet for this room, by the way, along with WordPress. I won't tell my friends at Acquia that, but it's pretty targeted. So I started at Acquia. We sold effectively website hosting to people running their sites on Drupal, and I was hired because sales and marketing at Acquia hated each other. And by hated, I mean there was a weekly meeting. The meetings were so contentious between the head of sales and head of marketing that they had a weekly meeting where the CEO and the CFO would sit in the room along with the head of sales and the head of marketing to like broker a peace agreement. It was wild. And it was because like the CMO was like, we have great leads. Look at our lead number. We're crushing it. And the head of sales was, but your leads suck. A tale as old as time. It's literally like Beauty and the Beast. It's as old as time. How many of you have ever had that conversation? Your leads suck. You don't work my leads. None of you have had that. Come on. We got a bunch of liars in this room. Bunch of liars. Now I know you all. So I was hired to fix that. And I'm like, I don't know, this meeting sounds stupid. Like, why don't we just agree on what a good lead is and like track it? I don't know, that sounds pretty easy to me. So it was a different size company. I was hired to come in and, again, fix demand gen. And then I made a bunch of mistakes. This is why, the reason I'm here in front of you today is because I screwed it up at this company. I should be a fractional CMO who sits on boards. I've never flown a private jet once. I feel like all my friends fly private jets. I've never flown a private jet. Well, we got one person in this whole room. I aspire to be you someday. Never flown a private jet. Can't even imagine what that's like. I sit in middle seats. All right, so my first mistake was I fell in love with the MQL. I now hate this idea of an MQL. So my way of fixing demand gen, you hate MQLs too? Let's get a stand up. Let's do a round of applause for hating MQLs. Lead us in that applause. And like the idea is cool, but like I owned an MQL number. My way to solve sales and marketing alignment was going to be, I'm going to give you more MQL sales. And so I got really good at doing webinars because there ain't no better way. See that Texas thing in me? Ain't y'all. There ain't no better way, y'all, to get MQLs than running a ton of webinars, right? Let's just MQL the heck out of our database. Let's get them to webinars. Let's email them. And if our scoring system is done wrong, which everyone's is, we're going to get a whole ton. Quick rant. Scoring systems of MQLs, I was a math major, are the dumbest things ever. So why do I get 3 points for a webinar, but 1 point for, like, what? Like, what math drove those decisions? Why is it 1 point, not 1.2 or 1.7? It's the dumbest thing. In fact, at this Acquia company, I ran an experiment. And the experiment was, we basically didn't tell sales this, but we passed half of our leads as our MQLs, the ones we scored. And then half of the leads were just random leads. Like, just we said they were MQLs, but they actually weren't. They were just random leads. And the random leads worked better than the MQLs. How disheartening is that when the random leads were like, sales, like, we love these leads. They're great. Really? They're just, like, crappy webinar leads. Okay. So I fell in love with this MQL, and oops, they didn't actually even convert better. Shame on me. Second thing I did, I love this cup here. Marketing attribution is fake. We just made the shit up. I mean, that is true. marketing attribution. Does anyone here believe marketing attribution is real? Because I want to know what you're on. You think attribution is real, don't you? I can tell. You do not think it's real. But I have UTM codes, do you? You have UTM codes. All right. That's cool. That's cool, bro. I love your UTM codes. It is fair. And we fought about attribution in Acquia Company. We would literally be in meetings. We fight between the holy trinity of pipeline sources, sales, marketing, and partners. And those partners, I don't want to swear in this group, those partner a-holes kept taking all my deals. Because they would say, no, dude, the partner registered that deal. What? The partners registered? They register everything. No, they register everything. So I would fight with the partner guy, and I would literally go into Salesforce and have to reverse engineer, do some anthropological investigation to get credit, like, so I don't get fired. So all we would do between me, the salesperson who owned the BDRs, and the partner person is we'd fight over credit for these leads so we didn't get fired. We weren't thinking about how do we get more, how do we work together, how do we actually focus on ARR? No, that's stupid. Why would we do that? No, we're going to go ahead and instead we're going to fight on credit so we don't get fired. That was pretty freaking stupid too. So attribution is fake. We should be focused on growing faster and not credit. Credit is directional. We should directionally understand some things, but I definitely learned that the hard way. And then the thing that I think I really screwed up on was I had no, and this is why we're here today, I had no idea how important it was to invest for the long term. So all I focused on this Acquia Company was, how do I hit my number this week? My metrics stay green? I never thought about, well, what happens a year from now or 2 years from now or 3 years from now? And by doing this, we'll see the results in a second. So, you know, my focus was just on how do we just create ops for the sales team? I didn't think and the bottom point is my point here, if it didn't generate leads or pipeline soon, like this week, this month, this quarter, didn't matter to me, could care less. Turns out I was wrong. And I cost this company, I believe, a chance at an IPO. Like in the hot IPO market in 2014, 2015, if I'd done better here, we go public and I'm not sitting in this room. And I go back to this, my key point, I had to unlearn this from Mike Volpe and John Miller, HubSpot and Demandbase. Marketing is more than just math, right? Yes, I was a mathematician, but I was looking at marketing entirely wrong. And I blame Dave Kellogg. Anyone know who Dave Kellogg is? I actually love Dave Kellogg. He's incredible. He's an advisor at Recorded Future. He writes this blog called kellblog.com. And if you haven't read kellblog.com, all of you should check it out. Dave is an absolute, like he's been blogging since, I don't even know the internet existed, like 2004. It's wild how many posts he's put together. But Dave is one of these guys that always talks about the demand gen side of marketing and how marketing is measurable and all the stuff I said was wrong. And I would tell Dave this if he were here. You know, Dave convinces every CMO to build a reverse funnel. A reverse funnel is very simply, you have a target as a company. You need to do $10 million in revenue. So to do $10 million in revenue, you need this many ops based on your close rate, based on your average deal size. You can work it all the way back to as far back up the funnel as you want, right? So Dave tells everybody to build this inverted funnel to tell you what you need to do. So that's great. Does anyone have an inverted funnel? I assume all of you these days have an inverted funnel. Yes, you know how many leads or accounts or whatever it takes to hit your number. You should have that. The problem is if you don't think about the actual, like what causes the engine, the funnel, the flywheel to work better. So some math is like this, where it's basically like, ARR targets grow by 40%, so everything else grows by 40%, but your budget turns out doesn't grow by 40% every year, right? So like, all right, so let's increase our ARR targets over time, but let's not increase our budget. So at some point, you get to a point where your growth targets can't be hit by the budget that you've been given. So the only way you get to your number is if some other step change or some other breakthrough in your funnel happens. But the only way that breakthrough and that funnel change is going to happen is if something around your company's brand has changed. So I never thought about this. I was always focused on this quarter and maybe next quarter. But if you don't think about it, you're going to get into what I call this MQL death spiral, which is the only way you're going to ever get to your number is by expand the top of your funnel. You're just going to have to keep hitting those people over and over again with emails and webinars and whatever, direct mail and whatever. When your spend starts to grow slower than your budget, you've got to figure out something else to do. And that was the big problem that I faced at Acquia, because when Acquia started, we had just received, we had just experienced product market fit. There were a bunch of companies running Drupal, and all we had to do was find them. Once we found them, we had a great value prop. It was really easy for us to say, hey, you're running Drupal. Guess what? Drupal's not very secure. No crap. It's not very secure. Drupal, it doesn't scale all that well. It's hard to upgrade Drupal. We had a really great value prop for Drupal. So I was great where there were a lot of companies in market for something better, and those companies, we had the right product for them, so we had a huge, huge pool of companies to fish from. So that was pretty easy, and we did awesome. The first couple of years, Acquia was literally number 8 in the Inc. 5000 ranking of fastest growing private companies. It was super easy. We could literally just find sites running Drupal and sell to them. It got harder, though, when we exhausted all of the companies who were running Drupal. Then we had to start figuring out, how do we get more companies to run Drupal over WordPress or over Adobe's products, or there's a million other CMS products out in the market. We had to convince companies to switch their CMS. Turns out that sliver was pretty darn small, and it also turns out that no one knew what a Drupal was. So in the Drupal universe, we did great. Once we had to convince the rest of the world, they didn't know what a Drupal was, and they for sure didn't know what an Acquia was. So I'm out there competing against some of the biggest companies in the world like Adobe, and we'd go in and sales would go into these opportunities, and no one would have any idea what a Drupal or Acquia were. So our sales slowed down. Our sales cycle got a lot longer. Our win rates got a lot lower. All the bad things that can happen in a business started to happen to me. So I started off as a demand gen genius, and a year later, I'm literally failing miserably. So my Acquia journey ended in 2015. I was there for 3 years. Did I get my Lambo? No. I did not fly private jet. I have a nice Tesla Model Y. I love it. I also do have a Cybertruck reservation, which I will get in, I think, 3 years from now, so that'll be cool. But I will not have my Lamborghini. Our growth rate was solidly in the mid-40s at Acquia for the first couple of years. Went down into the 20s, so that sucked. And we ended up getting acquired by Vista at a pretty low multiple, 3x revenue, which when we got acquired in 2019 was terrible. This is when everyone was getting bought for 20x revenue. We got bought for 3x. So I take a lot of accountability for failing at this, because by not taking the time to think long-term and to be strategic about how do we actually let the world know about what we do, by not doing that, I probably did cost Acquia an IPO. I certainly cost Acquia a bigger exit than 3x. And that's a big part of the reason why I'm here, and I flew, you know, middle seat Delta last night, or terrible seat in Delta. So I think this captures it a little bit for me. This is Rand Fishkin. Rand Fishkin, if you don't know, is the goat of SEO. And I saw this on LinkedIn. I turned it into my slide. It's weird to say, but I'm back on the time. It's time to waste half your marketing budget on the things you can't prove train. Because if you do that, the thing, half the things that do work will have so much higher ROI. And I think this is the reality of the world that we live in now. And even in this economy where, how many of you talked to your CFO more this year than you did in prior years? Like, those are tough conversations. Your CFO is like, hey, you know, we want to give you some money, but you got to prove to me this is working. And the way that we prove things are working, unfortunately, often leads to us making decisions that don't ultimately drive the business in the direction we're hoping for. So you have these people like Rand, again, who sort of grew up on performance marketing and SEO being a good example of performance marketing, saying, hey, it really is about something else. It really is about brand. It really is about the 50% of the stuff you spend on that you can't really prove. And I could not agree more. So this is where I've come to the conclusion that the way that I'm going to, prior to joining Recorded Future, the way I was going to change my career is I'm going to become a brand guy. I'm no longer going to pretend that marketing is the arts and crafts department, that I can only measure the things I can measure, that, you know, to the point I talked about earlier, I'm going to find things that are going to be unmeasurable on purpose, and I'm going to enthusiastically embrace that. And when I think about the idea of building a brand, which is what I'm trying to do, I always go back to my hero, big Steve Jobs guy. Love Steve Jobs, and when Steve Jobs talks about brand, it's just trust. A brand is simply trust. You can define brand in lots of different ways. Some people say it's what people say when you're out in the room, but But I think the one word answer is it's trust. If you are a brand, and trust doesn't always have to mean a good thing, and I'll show you an example of that in a second, but a brand is trust. Now that's what we're trying to do. If people trust Recorded Future, they're gonna buy more from Recorded Future. Seems like a pretty viable argument to me. So that's what I think about. And when I think about brands thriving on trust, when I think about Apple's brand, what Steve had done at Apple is it just works. Now, you can argue, if you're not an Apple fanboy like I am, that Apple products don't just work like they did maybe a couple of years ago or a decade ago. But still, when you think about Apple products, you feel pretty confident that when you go home for the holidays and your parents are using your iPhone or iPad, they're not going to come to you and say, hey, can you fix this for me? Apple products just work, right? McDonald's. Not a big fan of McDonald's, but as a brand, they're at least consistent. Whether you go to a McDonald's in Austin or a McDonald's in Vietnam, you're at least going to get the same experience. A quarter pounder with cheese and a Diet Coke is going to taste just about the same anywhere you go. So they are at least consistent. You know that a McDonald's property is going to be the same. And there's a tremendous amount of value in that. When I think of Louis Vuitton or LVMH, Recorded Future customer, luxury, right? If you buy an LVMH product, you're going to get the same level of luxury experience. Again, I don't know if you like it or not, but you're going to get the same thing. I think brands built on trust is what we all aspire to do as we build out brands for our own companies. Certainly that's been my thing. And when I think about demand generation, how many of you in this room carry the title demand generation? Shout out to all of you. You were all, did you know that you were all really brand builders? You didn't know this, you should change your title immediately. Brand manager, I don't know what your title should be. But you are, demand generators are brand builders. This is Eugene Schwartz's Scientific Advertising from 1960 or something. I wasn't born in that, so don't go that far back. I didn't read the first printing of this. I know you're all thinking, did Wentworth release? He's sixth? No. But I think this is a really simple framework for talking about the problem we're trying to solve, right? It's the dark blue, if somebody's product aware or most aware, that's where I was at Acquia, that's where I focused. I focused on people who knew that they had a problem because they own Drupal, and it was trivial for us. But I didn't think about the reality of 90% of our buyers at any one time who are either entirely unaware, they don't even know they have a problem, shame on them, to they're problem aware, but they don't know exactly how it can be solved. They don't know how to fix the insecurity of Drupal. To solution aware, they know there are products out there that do these sorts of things. They just don't know that your company is one of them. In my Acquia example, I was more in the problem aware stage where people knew there were other CMSs out there. They didn't know at all about my problem, my products. So when I think about demand generation now, I think about the light blue part of the scientific advertising framework here. This is where I want to spend my time. The people in the dark blue, the demand capture side of this, I think, you know, that's not easy, but it's much easier to have a conversation with somebody if they already know who you are. Then it's a different conversation. But the real bulk of where I spend my team's time these days is on this light blue part here in scientific advertising. So when I think about Recorded Future, so now we'll go on to the current part of my journey where I failed at my first job at Optimizely, failed miserably at Acquia. We're doing okay at Recorded Future. So when I took over marketing at Recorded Future in December of 2019, we were about 90 million in ARR. Now we're a little bit over 300. I started right before COVID, so that was fun. Started in December of 2019. Was told by the CEO, hey, you got a great team. We're growing fast. Our whole 2020 plan is locked in. We're going to do a ton of great events. It's going to be amazing. Yeah. So I got back from my first RSA ever in 2020, came back in the world obviously had what it had, but I promised myself going into this journey at Recorded Future that I would not repeat that mistake of the past that I'd made at Optimizing Acquia. I was going to figure out a way to get Recorded Future into these conversations using brand and focusing on brand awareness. So that was what I was going to do differently for the first time ever at Recorded Future. So this is how, this is a slide, this is an internal slide that I use and show at our company meetings. This is how we measure marketing at Recorded Future. So in the short term, days and weeks, every single day, and I hate, by the way, when someone says, hey, marketing, yeah, can you help me hit the quarter number this quarter? No, I actually can't. It's like December, dude, it's like we got 3 weeks left. I cannot, I'm sorry. I can help you hit Q2, because our sales cycles are about 6 months. Really gonna be hard for me to help you. We can talk about Q1, but I ain't talking about Q4. But I am going to focus on ops I can create this week to help you hit your Q2 number, and that's how I measured, and it's really still the bulk of the conversations that my CEO has with me. Second thing I focus on, obviously, in the medium term is in quarters particularly is, are we hitting our ARR goals? So obviously, we're in a competitive market. We compete primarily against CrowdStrike and Google Cloud / Mandiant. So we worry a lot about making sure that we're winning our fair share of deals, that the sales team has what they need from a collateral perspective, from an enablement perspective, from a competitive intelligence perspective. So I focus on that. But the new dark blue box I added to the right is really where I think Recorded Features figured something out that has helped us scale as fast as we had, which is we're putting about 25% of our effort, and maybe even a little bit more from a budget perspective, into this building brand awareness, into this let's make some investments in things that are really hard to prove and that aren't going to lead to direct response-like metrics. There's not going to be a button you can click on and book a demo, but over time, we think, are going to have a long-term impact on the first bullet. I think if you get really good at building brand awareness, that's the lubricant that makes your short-term stuff actually work. That's at least what we believe, and I'll show you a little bit about it in a second. But this is a big part of our team's focus. We are not just focused on the short term. About a quarter of everything we do is focused a lot more on the long term. And our go-to-market strategy is pretty simple. We are an account-based go-to-market team. So we think about terms and accounts. There's roughly 7,000 accounts or so that we focus on. And we think of it in two separate ways. The little blue box is our demand capture box. This is accounts that we know are in market looking for threat intelligence. So we want to make sure that we are able to identify those accounts, message them appropriately, deliver them the right solution, and ultimately get them into a meeting, right? This is the classic, you know, we measure ourselves on how many meetings do we book every week with these high intent accounts that are a good fit. So that's sort of the easy one. The big blue box are the rest of the 7,000 accounts. And by the way, for us, it's about 15% of our accounts are quote unquote in market at any one time. Like we think are actively looking for something. So that means 85% aren't. The big blue box, this is our demand generation box. And again, I think this is different than how we thought about in the past. Most people think about demand generation as a team that are about just booking the meetings or booking the demos. No, for us, it's how do we get in front of these 5,500, math major, how do we get in front of these 5,500 accounts and start building, you know, back to that messaging framework, how do we start getting our messages in front of these accounts based on the fact that most of them don't know what a recorded future is and maybe even don't know what a threat intelligence is. So we specifically run programs and campaigns that are designed both to capture the high intent demand and to help us, more importantly, create demand in those 5,500 accounts that we're talking about. So how do we create demand? This, again, is an internal slide. This is, if you worked at Recorded Future, you would see exactly this slide in our company presentation. And we look at it very simply. We create demand through these brand-driven investments. And there's three I'm going to talk about today. Our news organization called Recorded Future News, what we do with our PR program. And if you had told me 10 years ago that PR would be a demand generation tool, I would have literally laughed in your face and never talked to you again. And then our podcast. Wait, a podcast can drive demand? Really? Show me that one, Wentworth. I don't believe you. Yes, it can, and I'm going to show you how. So think about creating demand. These are brand-driven investments that we put a bunch of money and effort into. We then want to capture that demand. We've got a bunch of different things that we do to capture demand. We do all sorts of things that everybody in here does. We do a bunch of events, big ones, small ones. We do free trials, although we're mostly an enterprise go-to-market, top-down, not bottoms-up, not PLG. We've got this incredible daily newsletter I'll talk about a little bit called Cyber Daily. So we do a bunch of things that are meant, we find somebody who's high intent that we want to capture you, get you into a meeting and sell you something, and then 5 to 6 months later, that turns into our clients. So I think the net new thing here for us, when I talk to our salespeople about, hey, you know, the way that we are focused on over a much longer period of time getting the Recorded Future brand because we want you to trust us, and we'll talk about why trust is so important here on the left. You know, the way that we're going to get Recorded Future in front of people, so when you're having a conversation with a prospect, they might know Recorded Future. Like, these are different sets of tactics. And this is another internal slide just to capture how we think about things annually. We think about these, we call these plays. So we have three plays, three go-to-market plays. Plays are just ways for us to organize all of our efforts in a smart way. Our first play, we call our market the market play, is about creating demand. So our first, from a prioritization perspective, play two is about new logo acquisition, play three is about expansion. But our first play that we talk about the most is how do we make the market aware of Recorded Future? And maybe more importantly, how do we make the market aware of threat intelligence? No one knows what threat intelligence is. Any of you know what threat intelligence is? I love you. Thank you. Will you be buying soon? Do you have budget for Q4? If you have budget for Q4, we could use the deal. It's a tough out there. It's about $100,000, so it's a big budget. It's not going to fit in your credit card. But like, we are not endpoint. We are not a SIM. We are not a SOAR. We are not a firewall. So we put a bunch of effort into educating the market on what a threat intelligence is. We didn't do that in my prior job. We do that now. That is one of the things that we do that helps us create that long-term funnel. So play one is about creating long-term brand awareness for threat intelligence, which will even help our competitors in some ways. That's fine. The threat intelligence category is sort of growing. It's not obviously as established as what many of you in this room do. And then brand awareness for Recorded Future. We want people to know that Recorded Future is the largest threat intelligence vendor. So it's the first play that we run. It's something we put resources into. And we specifically run three plays at Recorded Future with building brand. The first is with news. And this one was, lucky might be too strong of a word. I was in London at a Nobu hotel. There's a Nobu hotel right next to my office. I wasn't there because I'm fancy. Just happened to be right next to our office. And I was there with my head of PR at the time. And we were talking about like how we were doing so well with our PR program. But there was so much news around cyber out there that a lot of stories weren't getting told. And we like brainstormed on a whiteboard the next day. What if we started our own news organization? What if we looked at Bloomberg? Like Bloomberg is kind of our model. We call ourselves the Bloomberg of cyber. You know, Bloomberg, we all know Bloomberg for Bloomberg News, right? They do great financial reporting. But Bloomberg sells terminals. They sell terminals to hedge fund traders and commodities traders. And Bloomberg clients value the depth and accuracy and breakingness of the reporting they get from Bloomberg. So what if we became the Bloomberg of cyber? What if we just own the news cycle? What if we went out and built a real news organization, not a content marketing organization? It's really important to know. So we started a group at Recorded Future called Recorded Future News. They report to me, but barely, like only in name only. In fact, there's a separate business entity for Recorded Future News. They have a different code in our finance systems. Like they are really a bit of a separate organization. But we went out and hired an editor-in-chief from Bloomberg/Wall Street Journal, who then went out over a couple of years and hired a bunch of really well-known cyber reporters. We've got reporters who focus on breaches and the technical side of cyber. We've got reporters who focus on nation-state issues. We've got a reporter who lives in Ukraine, and she is on the ground every day, literally in Kyiv, reporting on what's happening. We get incredible access with what she's doing, and it's literally inspiring what she's been able to do there. We have seven reporters who every single day publish 7 or 8 articles on a variety of cyber topics. We're now at the point where we're getting just about 1 million page views a month, which is pretty incredible. And as far as I can tell, the only site that seems to be bigger than us at this point, so if you think about in cyber, you've got Dark Weeding and CyberScoop and both great properties. But I think we're bigger than them now, and I think the only site that's maybe bigger than us at this point is the Hacker News. So back to brand being trust. We did this investment because we believe that, first of all, this is an important thing for us to do. We want to be able to share the news of cyber. But if people trust us for the news, they're probably going to trust that Recorded Future's products do what we say they're going to do. So this is completely a trust and awareness investment from us. We get, again, almost 1 million page views, so we'll do over 10 million this year and more next year. And we know our accounts are going here. We know our accounts are visiting the site. They tell us all the time, hey, I love the news that you're out there breaking. It's been an incredible investment, and it is literally a $0 investment other than people. We don't spend a dollar promoting anything. The vast majority of our traffic is organic. A bunch comes from referrals. Like, other people will cover our news. So we're not paying a dollar for any of this traffic. And in 2 years, we built an over 10 million page view apparatus. It's pretty incredible. So we don't think of this as a marketing investment at all. We think of this as it happens to have a pretty great benefit back to marketing because people will find out about Recorded Future through what we're doing with Recorded Future News. Really, really cool thing that we did here. And again, not a marketing investment, a news investment, a media investment. The second thing we've done is this podcast. So we heard about CyberWire earlier. Our podcast is a 6-year overnight success. For the first 4 years of our podcast, we worked with CyberWire. So we've done over 600 episodes, which is amazing. And I wasn't here when that podcast started, so I don't get any credit at all for it. But we work with CyberWire, and 52 weeks a year, we publish an episode. Back then, it was mostly focused on, we used Dave Bittner, who's got a voice like a hero, a Greek god, incredible voice. And they would book guests for us, and it was pretty turnkey. They'd produce the podcast for us, and we did that for 4 years. And it was, six-figure-ish investment, pretty good ROI. And we had good traction. It was good, not great. But we decided a couple years ago that, hey, we can really double down on this podcast thing. We think we can use this as a bit of a unique channel for Recorded Future. So instead of just continuing with CyberWire, we really love them and happy to see the cyber marketing team working with CyberWire. They're great. Yes, they're great. Fantastic. Really happy to see. That was going to be one of my suggestions is work with CyberWire, but now you've taken them from the community. Thief. So we went out and hired a real podcast team. Building a podcast is expensive. The hardest thing about podcast is everybody thinks they can drop a mic on a table, put a little reverb on the mic, put a little noise canceling, and you got a podcast. No one cares. You're not Joe Rogan, even though you're here in Austin. You're not Joe Rogan. Your interview-style podcast is not going to break you through. No one cares. So we really had to think differently. We wanted a podcast that was not just a top tech podcast, but we wanted to reach a real audience. So we went out and hired this woman, Dina Temple-Raston from NPR. Dina also has a voice like an angel. I encourage you to listen. It's literally incredible. She ran a couple of the most successful podcasts at NPR. And when Dina decided to join us, she said, hey, to make this podcast work, I'm going to need to, hire 4 people. Like, what? 4 people for a podcast? It turns out podcasting is hard. We treat our podcast a lot like we treat making a movie. We've got a showrunner. We've got a script writer. We've got an editor. We've got a producer. We've got people that spend their, I can't believe this is even a thing, but they spend their entire week working on a podcast. So Dina took over about 2 years ago, and she built a narrative-driven, so she's not talking about breaking news or doing an interview. She flew into Ukraine about a month ago and was on the site looking at a clandestine drone manufacturing factory that they're running in Ukraine to help protect themselves in the war. She is doing investigative journalism, really deep type reporting on stories. And the cool thing about it is our audience, and again, no offense to our previous podcast, literally tripled. So now, depending upon the week, this little stupid chart here is our ranking in our tech news category. Every single week, it's generally speaking, Bloomberg, New York Times, something, and Recorded Future. So we have now, I think, the highest ranked cyber podcast, in the cyber category. But I don't know there are very many vendor podcasts that are doing much better than this. And I think the reason that it's different is we put investment into it. We didn't just wing it. We didn't just drop a mic in front of somebody. And we also took a different approach. We are telling a much different type of story with this podcast than I think you see in most cyber podcasts. And it's been pretty incredible. And back to my initial point, people do actually tell us they love this podcast and it's why they trust Recorded Future. The last thing is PR. PR has mostly been a failure at every other company that I've worked at. And at Recorded Future, it's been one of our most successful channels. And there's a very clear reason for this. We have a research organization called INSICT who puts out some of the best research on Russia and China. So if you want to learn about what Russian and Chinese threat actors are up to, our INSICT research team is writing about them. It turns out what's happening in Russia and China is very interesting to mainstream media. So we can go, every time we put out a new report, we can go to Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, pick your tier one media provider, and we say, hey, look, we've got this research coming out. I'd like to share it with you if you're interested in covering it, and they do. It's been wildly successful, and almost every single day, we have tier one media coverage covering Recorded Future. The other thing that we've done is we just have lots of experts. So we have a guy on our team named Alan Liska, who is ransomware guru. Anyone know Alan in this room? One person. Alan's great. So anytime there's a ransomware story, anytime news breaks, CNN, a producer will call Alan, doesn't call Recorded Future, will call Alan directly, and Alan is on CNN 4 hours later in his house, wearing his Recorded Future shirt, describing himself as Alan Lipscott from Recorded Future. So by having experts at Recorded Future and by having some great research, we've turned PR into something that's been incredibly successful, and we don't even spend a dollar on an agency. This is what people, like most people spend, how many of you spend more than $10,000 a month in PR? Bunch of liars in this room. You know, big companies spend $70,000, $80,000, six figures plus on their PR, and I have nothing against PR agencies, but we've been able to do it mostly inbound. They come to us, we help connect them with experts at our company, but we spend almost very little, and every single day, we're in some of the biggest publications in the world. Those are three things that we've done that I think are super important. Then your question's gonna be, all right, Wentworth, how do you measure it? We don't, YOLO, measure, who cares? It's marketing, we don't measure it anymore. Remember the 50% we don't measure? We don't measure marketing. That doesn't fly either, can't do that. We do measure something. So we look at Click Here podcast as a feeder to our daily newsletter. So we'll do a read in our podcast. Hi, this is Dina Temple-Raston. You should, if you like this news, you should check, I'm doing my Dina impression. You should check out Recorded Future's Cyber Daily Newsletter. Our newsletter sources 15 to 20% of our pipeline every quarter. One newsletter we pay very little to promote sources 15 to 20% of our pipeline. Pretty cool asset for us. So we have the podcast, the Cyber Daily Measure, the record to Cyber Daily. Our news site also drives subscriptions to our daily newsletter at Recorded Future. One of the tricky things we do is we use Sixth Sense at Recorded Future. We've dropped our Sixth Sense tag on the record. So when I said earlier the record's really not a marketing thing, well, I do happen to know which accounts visit the record. That helps drive some of that intent we talked about earlier. So I can tell you definitively that 80% of the clients that we sell to are visiting the record within 30 days of us doing a purchase. One of the ways I know the record's working is because 80% of our clients are on it on a monthly basis. That's pretty cool. We also just do self-reported attribution. One of the simplest and dumbest, but yet it works, is just ask somebody why they came to your site. We do that, and people tell us, I think it was as high as 6 or 7% said, I did that demo request because your podcast is great. Or, you know, I love your news organization. We see this all the time, and that's enough attribution for me to prove my point. So I go back before we get to what you can all do. Kit Bodner is the CMO at HubSpot, the new CMO, not the old one. HubSpot is a multi-billionaire org, and I saw this quote from him recently. He's like, we're doing this big brand campaign. The same company, by the way, that told you everything had to be measurable 10 years ago, now said, this campaign was designed to increase awareness and consideration. There are no key metrics we're looking at here. So next time somebody says to your campaign, hey, you know, what are the key metrics you're looking at, or at least for your awareness campaign, you put this picture of Kip up, you say, yeah, you know that HubSpot company? Yeah, they're bigger than we are. They're super successful. If they don't measure it, why do we have to measure it? I'm going to use this in every single CFO conversation I have going forward. The same exact slide, by the way, with the cyber marketing con branding. All right, so what could work for you? I put together some very simple flowcharty stuff for big, medium, and small budget tactics based on my experience. Let's talk about big budget tactics first. Do you want to sponsor an F1 car? Anyone here sponsor an F1 car? Oh, goodness. Well, you really? Do you? Who do you work for? Oh, gosh. Yeah, you can afford it. Fair enough. All right. You know, Arctic Wood, Wolf has one, CrowdStrike, an F1 car. It goes around in a little circle. Should you sponsor one? I don't know. What about a sports team? Should we sponsor a sports team? Rapid 7 sponsored the Bruins out in Boston. The logo's on their jersey. What about a Super Bowl ad? Y'all saw CrowdStrike did a Super Bowl ad. I didn't know what it meant. A couple of years ago, Cyber Reason did one. Like owls flying, mechanical owls flying around. Does anyone care about mechanical? They're drunk. It's like the fourth quarter. No one's paying attention to the owl. Splunk did one, so maybe we should do one too. In fact, I'm here today to break a little bit of news at Recorded Future. We are now the jersey sponsor of the San Jose Sharks. Actually, not true. Don't. This is fake. They sent me this jersey in the mail. ABM campaign. It was the best ABM campaign I've ever seen. They sent this jersey in this like package that had a screen built in that showed like this hype video from the San Jose Sharks. So I now have the world's only Recorded Future thing with a San Jose Sharks with a jersey on it. I did not actually do this, but it's a cool jersey. I was gonna bring it with me, but I forgot it yesterday. So the honest answer is, if you've got that big of a budget where you can do an F1 car or sponsor a jersey, what are you listening to me for? Why are you, I should be listening to you. Like, let's talk later. I don't know. Generally speaking, I think the problem here is when medium budget companies think they're big budget companies. If you've got the CrowdStrike budget, like, what else you got to spend money on? Something. You're printing money. What else are you going to do? Yes, you can do whatever you want. Wentworth should have no opinion there. But I have seen examples where medium budget companies, companies with budgets smaller than mine that I know are spending $7, $8 million on a Super Bowl campaign. Don't do that. The ROI is not there. Instead of trying to rent an audience, build an audience, you'll get much better results, I think. We'll skip over that. We've only got one big budget brand in here anyway, and they can do this better than I can. I got no, you do you. All right. Should we build a media company? Everybody, how many, you've all heard, let's build a media company. We're going to build a media company like it's easy. Yeah, let's just build a media company. That sounds simple. Let's do that. Should we? How about PR? We talked about PR. Well, should PR work for you? Or should you just not do PR at all? That's maybe a reality. And then events, everyone's favorite brand building thing. Let's talk about events, because events, I might have a little bit different of a take here than you've heard. All right, so should you become a media company? The answer is probably not. It requires a big time commitment. You've got to spend at least 12 months, like the podcast. Great to hear, you know, that we've done your podcast now for 90 episodes. It's great. Most podcasts stop after like 10 because no one listens. So if you're going to start a podcast or do any other form of media, it is a 12-month investment. You've got to put a whole bunch of effort into things like production value so that people don't think that you're, you know, that you've got to put actual dollars into it. I think the reality is most companies don't have the commitment to put into becoming this media company. It's maybe a worthwhile thing to do, but if you're going to do it, commit to it for at least 12 months. If you can't commit to it for 12 months, you should say no. Or if you're thinking about this as a content marketing investment, meaning it's going to just going to drive leads, there are better ways to invest your time and resources. There are better return you're going to get. Only think about becoming a media company if you're really willing to put a whole bunch of effort into it. For Recorded Future, it was hiring real podcasters, hiring real journalists. There are about 10 people on my team now, on a team of 55, who are attached to this Recorded Future news organization. It was a big investment for us. And don't, if you're going to do it, be strategic about it. What about PR? Should you do PR? Also, probably not. Again, PR people in the room, I'm sorry. I don't want to rain on your parade. But PR is maybe one of the most wasted budget line items you have. You spend $20,000, $25,000 a month to get into trade publications that you could get in anyway. So the reality with PR is you have to have something interesting to say that reporters care about. And those two things are important. Is it interesting, meaning are you uniquely able to provide some insights? If not, you don't offer a reporter all that much value. And is it something reporters care about? Your story might be incredible. Like, reporters care about AI right now. That's why they will write a million stories about OpenAI. But if the thing that you're doing in cyber isn't all that interesting, it doesn't matter how much you spend with your PR retainer, you're not going to get any coverage at all. So even fundraising these days, if you've raised money and you've had to pitch journalists, they don't care. Like, they used to care. They don't care anymore about fundraising. It's really hard to have a successful PR program. Again, it comes down to, do you have something to say, and is it something they care about? And if that's the case, I would still argue you probably don't need a PR agency. Reporters just want to talk to you. So here's a picture of me wearing exactly the same outfit, by the way. I saw this and could not be more embarrassed by this. I'm like, do I have one outfit? What am I, a child? This is me and Anissa from The Information. She covers cloud computing. The Information is by far my favorite news outlet. And I sat down with her a couple months ago and it's like, hey, I don't really know much about being a reporter. Like, what do you care about? And she was super cool. And she's like, look, when you want to reach me, if you write about what I care about, I'm going to take my meeting with you. So she covers Google, big cloud tech company. So it's pretty narrow. But if you come to me with a pitch that's directly related to what I cover, I'll take your call. You can email me, call me, I'll read it. And I really want to hear from the founder or the expert. I really don't want you to go through the PR agency, which I thought was very strange as well. Like, I want to build a direct relationship with an executive of the company so that I can have conversations meaningful quickly. So she's like, I don't mind PR agencies. Some are good, some are bad. I just want to talk to you. I want to be able to text the executive when something happens to get commentary in near real time. So I think the most important thing with talking about somebody like Anissa at The Information is just, first of all, she's just a human. She's just like a normal person. She just wants companies to give her information that's relevant to her, and she gets measured on scoops, which I thought was also interesting. She doesn't get measured on page views. Her job is to break news at the information. I don't know if that's the case for everybody, but it's literally how she gets measured. She hits her bonus if she breaks scoops. Let's talk about the cousin of PR, which is AR. I hire this in regs. This is a hot take alert. I know there are some ex-analysts in here. I used to be all about that Gartner and Forrester life. I spent a bunch of money, bunch of effort, a couple $100,000 a year in analyst subscriptions. Until, frankly, 2 weeks ago, not 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago, we didn't even have a Forrester subscription at Recorded Future. Gartner doesn't write an MQ in our threat intelligence space. Forrester does. We didn't have a subscription. I just haven't seen analysts move the needle like I did 5 to 10 years ago. We spend very little money and very little effort in analyst relations. My take here is I think there are other ways to influence. We've got an influencer conference happening here. I think analysts have less influence than they did in the past. You have to figure this out for yourself. Back to my earlier point, it's a hot take a little bit, but I don't know that spending your $100, $150, $200,000 a year retainer with analysts is the best use of your limited marketing dollars. And then let's also talk quickly about events. So events, big events like Black Hat and Red Hat, small events like roadshows. You know, my take here is that I'm sick of paying the big events tax. Are any of you sick of paying the big events tax? Yes. So we didn't do Black Hat this year at Recorded Future, which was a controversial decision with our chief revenue officer. What? You're going to do Black Hat? What do you mean we're not going to have a booth there? But our competitors are going to have booth, and they're going to think that we're bankrupt. I'm like, no, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen at all. And it didn't happen. So we did not do Black Hat. We will not do Black Hat again this year. And I got nothing against Black Hat. I mean, Black Hat's fine. I just didn't want to spend $350,000 anymore just to have a booth and scan the same people that come every single year. I've already got your, I don't want to scan you anymore. I'm done. I don't want you to come and grab my t-shirt. I'm done. I can't. So we had a presence at Black Hat. We had a room. We booked meetings. We did a party. It was cool. We just didn't spend the $350,000 on our booth. It was fine. The world didn't end. We are still doing RSA, which we'll probably continue to do, but maybe, you know, it's on the table every year. We every year are having a discussion if we should just eliminate it altogether. What we are doing instead that works better for us are just small regional events. We call it the Intelligence Roadshow. We do about 100 of them a year, and the basic math is pretty simple. Like, RSA has some people we like, or we like everybody, some accounts we can sell to, some we don't, but if I do my own roadshow, I can pretty much guarantee the right people are in the room every single time, so my marketing dollars are going exactly towards the accounts that we know we can sell to, and it's a lot cheaper. So we cut our events investment in Recorded Future, and we frankly got better results. So I think the takeaway here is you don't have to just do every single big trade show just because you're head of sales or your CEO says so. Often there are better things you can do that same money and get better returns. And then my last 2 points here about small budget, where a lot of you are. The first one is your founder has to be the marketer. If you were at a startup, if you've got, you know, no marketing budget, which probably a lot of you have, you have got to work at a company where the founder does the brand building. If your founder doesn't like marketing, quit. How many of you are going to admit that you have a founder who doesn't like marketing? You should quit. I'm sorry. We can help you. You're in the right place. You're with family here. We can help you find a new job. You tell your founder I said so to you. Send him with me. I'll talk. I'll straighten him out or them out. So it just won't work. Your founder has to be your brand builder. Your founder has to be comfortable getting out there and sharing their story. If you're doing something interesting, you would thank your founder. But if your founder just wants to lock themselves in a room and write code, it's not going to work. The only no-budget marketing tactic that works, especially you can do all the demand capture stuff we talked about earlier with no budget, but you need your founder out there telling the story, reaching out to those reporters who care about what you do, writing the content on LinkedIn, using social media effectively. Your founder has to lead marketing with no budget. If not, you've got to try something else. It honestly won't work. I've seen this movie too many times. And then, which we just talked about, and then social media, my last advice here is social media is great. Most of us suck at it because all we do are post webinar links, right? We use social media as a way to post webinar links, and that is not good. So 2 pieces of advice here. Advice number one, pick a channel. You are too small with no budget to be everywhere. I don't care what the channel is. I love YouTube and I love Mr. Beast. Any Mr. Beast fans in here? Why is there no Mr. Beast of cyber? Or why is there no Mr. Beast of B2B? You were all failing at your job as marketers, and me, I'm failing too, by not finding a way to get on YouTube or using YouTube Shorts. The YouTube audience is amazing. Someone in this room should go, and I've done the research, there's no cyber brand on YouTube. Someone could dominate that for very cheap. Just post great content. Pick a channel, I don't care what it is, could be LinkedIn. I think there's this idea of channel arbitrage though, where you wanna be where other people aren't. No one in cyber is on YouTube, maybe you should be there. People have given up on Twitter. Elon Musk is a weird dude. or X, whatever you call it. There's arbitrage there because everyone else is leaving. Maybe you can be on there. And keep people on the platform. Don't post link, demand gen form. One of the big changes we made this year with Recorded Future News was we just want to share the news itself on the channel. So we wanted to, you can get everything you need without ever having to go to our site, and that was cool. All right, congratulations, everybody. You made it through my talk. I will be here for questions. I'm sure I answered every question. Thank you so much for your time, your smiles. I really appreciate it. Thank you.